And tonight you are hearing ESP Wars. Lloyd Auerbach, our guest, Ed May, and we'll be back with both of them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Lloyd Auerbach with us, Ed May, as we talk about their work, ESP Wars. And Lloyd, some time ago you wrote The Ghost Detective's Guide to Haunted San Francisco. I would assume most cities are haunted, aren't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, places seem to hold memories, and that relates back to haunting, certainly.
And Ed, how about you? Eddie, have you come across anything haunting recently?
No, I'm afraid I have not.
That's not your ball game, is it?
Well, fortunately, what's nice about the research world of parapsychology is you get to have people with different interests and different skill level. I couldn't do with what Lloyd does, but what he does I find exceptionally fascinating.
Well, there's no question about it. And Ed, tell me this, too. When you were in India with the yogis, and you said that you really didn't see anything unusual, why not? I thought those people were really tuned in.
Well, let me give you just a brief piece of history, George.
Okay.
I've had a long-time connection to India. I'm not chasing miracles or going after seeking spiritual enlightenment or anything like that. My best friend in graduate school was an Indian fellow, and he invited me to join him in 1971, my first trip there, and we spent 6 weeks playing tourists. I fell in love with the country, and particularly his family. And here we are now 40-some-odd years after that, and I'm an integral part of his family. He passed away quite a number of years ago, but now I'm a surrogate father for his three sons, two of whom live in the States, and they're in their early 40s now. So I go to India about once or twice a year, every year since 1971. And even though I'm extremely familiar with that culture, being a white person looking to do this kind of research, frankly, that's a cultural mismatch. That's not due to racism or anything else. It's just outside of each other's culture. And so probably one of the reasons I didn't see anybody having abilities is that, A, I was asking the wrong questions. B, there's a huge barrier between the cultures that might have prevented it. But I certainly saw tons of fraud and so on. And my suspicions are we've done work through the Stargate program to try to figure out about what fraction of the population meets kind of laboratory criteria for being psychic, and it's about 0.25%. Now, that doesn't mean just 0.25% of U.S. people. It's just a lucky guess, probably. That's not too far off for even India or China or any other place on the planet. It's part of being human.
Well, yeah, but it is surprising, though, that they didn't have the kind of enlightenment that I thought they would.
Well, one of the things about it is in India, and I think other cultures as well, but I'm most familiar there, when it comes time to these kinds of abilities, which are deeply embedded in the culture and through the religious parts, and in yoga you have something called the siddhis, although most spiritual teachers will tell you you don't want to go down that path because it's leading you away from spiritual enlightenment. But because that is so ingrained in the people who make those claims that they can do things like levitate or walk through walls or a whole list of miracles, no one, and I mean no one, will criticize you. Now, they do have groups in India. You can go online. Near Mukta is one online that you can go to. And sure, they're the rationalist people, like running around screaming and yelling. But they are a very small fraction of the population, and most people just say, oh, yeah, that's real. I mean, I could go to downtown Bombay, a modern big city, and claim I saw Swami Fakenanda climb up a pink rope carrying an elephant under his arm, and I could get sworn affidavits of other witnesses that saw the thing too, even though I made it up. And so that makes it really hard for outsiders of any place to do that kind of research.
Now, also, when you were doing your work in the psychic realm through ESP Wars, you talked about the Soviets wanting to use this as a kind of a weapon. How would they have used it?
Well, if they were successful, as I said earlier, it would be non-lethal weaponry. They weren't really trying to use it as a weapon to kill people on the battlefield. Rather, they were just trying to bias very sensitive negotiations. In fact, I don't think we mentioned this in the book, but there were cases where even in international chess matches, the Soviets had some of their psychics planted the audience to get the foreign competitors who were doing chess with the Soviets to try to make them sick so they would lose their matches. That didn't work.
It's something similar to psychological warfare, but more on a psychic level where, you know, they're not doing anything using normal senses or perception.
Let's talk, if we can, Lloyd, just for a moment about the ghost world and what you think that side mm-hmm. might be. Again, it's probably all tied together, ESP, psychic work, research, the ghost world. It's all the same, isn't it?
Well, in a lot of respects, yes. I mean, there are people in my field who differ on the issue of whether consciousness survives the death of the body, regardless of what consciousness actually starts out with, you know, when you're alive. I lean towards, and the evidence to me says that there is something about human beings that survives the death of the body. If there is a consciousness that survives, that consciousness is using ESP to pick up information to actually perceive the world. I mean, if you're without a body, you have no eyes and ears and normal senses, and you have to be able to perceive and even communicate, and that ESP makes a perfect thing for you to do that with. You perceive that way and maybe even communicate that way. So it's all tied together.
Precognition, same thing?
Well, precognition, by definition, is knowing before something happens.
Yeah.
And that's an area I know that Ed is very interested in, and you know, I'm interested in that as well. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can't change things going forward if you have the information about what's likely to happen. And there's a question of probabilities, too. Are we picking up the actual future or the probable future that's happening there?
Ed, your thoughts on precognition. Go ahead.
I go so far on a couple of areas that I'm at odds with the rest of my colleagues, which makes it fun. I'm not sure that we do survive our bodily deaths. I'm very much a materialist in that regard. But I think there may be only one form of extrasensory perception, not telepathy and clairvoyance. The only one that really works would be precognition. And there's some physics reasons why I think that's the case. But that raises the interesting philosophical question. If you can see the future, are you condemned to experience that future? Now, it may come as a surprise to everyone, but we've actually been able to do research on that very, very specific question. You know, I think, gosh, how blessed am I? I've got the government to pay me to do research on answering those kind of age-old questions. And, you know, it's been popular in science fiction writing, you know, that you have you see yourself getting hit by a truck in the morning and you try everything you can to avoid that happening, but you can't. Turns out when you look at that carefully in the laboratory, you apparently have access to probable futures, but ones that will not necessarily happen. So if you have a psychic dream that you're going to get hit by a truck, well, just stay in bed today. You won't get hit by that truck.
I like that. ESP, by its definition, extrasensory perception, to me sounds like some people have that extra boost, other people don't. Lloyd?
Well, sure.
Well, yeah, that is true. And, you know, it's perception. And what extrasensory means is it's not the normal senses. You know, we have the sensory functions, and the information goes into our brain processing system. And then we have perception of those of the data that the senses have picked up on. And there are certainly more than five senses at this point as we've identified. But whether ESP itself is based the same way, it doesn't seem to have a sensory structure the same way the other senses do. At least not one that we have been able to determine yet. And that's always. The word yet is always important to throw in there.
Well, one of the things that encouraged me to think that it really is a sensory kinds of system is this. Of all the senses that we know about, all of them are better detecting changes than things that are not changing. For example, back in the days when astronomers actually looked through telescopes, to find a very faint thing that they were looking for, what they would do is move their eyes back and forth because they could see something faint when their eyes were going back and forth across it. So the photons hitting the eye were changing when that happened. Or someone walks in the room with too much perfume or cologne on, guess what? You think, oh, you noticed that. And then after a while, it fades away. that's called habituation in the literature. And what that means is we are sensitive to things that are changing in our sensory systems compared to those same things when they're not changing, much more sensitive. And so what we've been able to find in the laboratory, ESP actually works that exact same way. There's something that ESP is much more sensitive to when something is changing compared to when it is not. And that begins to look like the behavior of all of the other five senses we're familiar with.
Lloyd, when you started doing this, mm-hmm. was there a point in your career that got you into it? I mean, what happened?
Well, for me, it was actually an interest in potential psychic abilities that from when I was a kid watching TV shows, comic books actually got me interested in it. But I think because I was a little science geek as a kid, when I started reading books by J.B. Ryan and J.G. Pratt, some of the folks who were in parapsychology, and that was because I was sent to the library from watching Dark Shadows and wanted to read books on vampires and werewolves and folklore, which I was also interested in. And lo and behold, I discovered in the same section of the library, sadly for parapsychology, with vampire books, were books on ESP. But that really captured my imagination. And in high school, I was fortunate to actually have a couple teachers in the physical sciences who were interested in the subject, and they helped sponsor a parapsychology club that I started. And through that, through one of a couple of my neighbors, I got to meet people who were in the field and in the New York area. And that was a big push for me. So it wasn't experiential for me other than to experience the evidence that had already been gathered in the laboratory. And that really, I never had a problem with the idea of people being able to do this. So the evidence was absorbable by me. And I've seen other people that have a problem with even the possibility that ESP is real, and they refuse to even look at the evidence. So you kind of have opposite ends of the spectrum here.
No doubt. No doubt at all. Go ahead, Ed.
George, when I returned from India, and I said earlier I didn't see anything that convinced me psychic abilities were real, I worked with Charles Onaton at a place called Maimonides Medical Center, which is a huge teaching hospital in Brooklyn. And in the division of psychiatry, there was a department of parapsychology, actually, in that teaching hospital. And one of the funny things we did, when someone would call on the phone, we'd answer the phone and say, "Hello, Division of Parapsychology, may we tell you who's calling?" And so that got huge cognitive dissonance on the other end of the phone. But I saw more psychic things, as it were, in the basement of Maimonides Medical Center in the space of 8 months where I was there than my entire year in India.
Why isn't ESP accepted by most people?
Well, because we're all human, and we have that experience. I had one like that not long ago. A very close friend of mine was passing away. He was very ill, and about a day or two before he died, we were joking about reincarnation, and I said, "Hey, look, when you pass away, come and pinch me on my rear end and wake me up."
And show me a sign, right?
Exactly. So he said, "Yeah, I'll give it a shot." And I'm a very sound sleeper. You could have the river dancers with the lights on dancing on my bed in the middle of the night, and I would not wake up. So it's very rare for me to wake up. And I woke up one morning at about 12:45 in the morning, and I thought, "Oh, this is really weird. My clock must be broken." So I got up and went down to look at my computer, and sure enough, my clock was right. I just dismissed it. The next day, my friend's wife called me up and said he had passed away at 12:45 that morning.
Wow. See, how do you explain that? There aren't coincidences. These things happen.
They do. They happen, and you know, people. The majority of the public, most of the polls show that people accept the possibility, at least, of ESP. That's outside the academic community and, you know, mainstream science, where they have a vested interest personally in looking at things a certain way. There's a lot of biases there, just like there are in certain religious groups.
How can we use ESP? Lloyd and Ed, how can we use it in our day-to-day living for our own benefit?
I think we could turn the question around. We all use it to some degree. For example, there was a book written in 1972 called Executive ESP. And Lloyd, remind me who the author was. I'm blanking on it right now.
It is Douglas Dean and John Mihalaski.
Thank you, Douglas Dean. And what he did was, a long story short, he embedded in, he put in covert ESP tests among all kinds of other tests for executives in weekend executive training courses. And the net of all this was there was a huge correlation between the executive's salary and their scores on the ESP test, even though they didn't believe in ESP. And quite one way of interpreting that is you get paid the big bucks by making wiser decisions in the absence of data, and that's what a lot of executives have to do. So I think we all use it unconsciously, probably, all the time. The successful people among us use it slightly all the time.
Is it a process of the brain, or are we tapping into this unknown force out there in the universe?
Well, there's a huge debate continuing in within our field, and probably Lloyd and I have a slightly different viewpoint. I think it's completely in the brain.
Well, and, you know, what you're saying, George, you're asking, you know, information is outside our heads, but we see things. So it is in the brain. Whether if consciousness is in the brain, it's in the brain. If consciousness is beyond the brain, then it's beyond the brain. Just wherever that actually resides, that's the big question.
And, Ed, are you saying then that remote viewing is simply tied to the brain?
Yes, I think so. My colleague and I in India have a model, physics model, about how precognition works. There's some strong indication with our super psychics that we work with now full time, is that there are certain brain processes which we think result in how we process the information in the head. How it gets from outside the head into the head is still a huge mystery. But once it's on board in the head, we have some testable ideas about the way that would work within the brain. I happen to think that consciousness itself is an emergent property of the brain, and that's a hot debated topic in academia, so there are lots of people that disagree about that. There are a lot of people who agree, and that's the best way science moves forward, is the disagreements on the edges of science that teach us what is actually going on.
Okay, but if we die, the physical body is gone, the brain is gone, how then can we explain all these other psychic things that happened? You know, the ghostly apparitions, the possibility of reincarnation, life after death, if most of this is centered in the brain?
Well, that's an excellent question. And if it were true, and that's a big if in my view, and less so in Lloyd's, but if it were true that one could definitively show that the reincarnation cases, and some of those are just knock your socks off time, were that there was not some other explanation for them, then I would say, my goodness, consciousness does survive our bodily death, and all this wonderful things about ESP and remote viewing maybe have nothing to do with the brain actually at the end of the day. There was a professor of medicine at the University of Virginia, the late Ian Stevenson, who probably has done the definitive work in reincarnation. And he finally would easily admit that there is another explanation, not fraud, I'm not accusing anybody of cheating here, that would equally explain the data. And that is, let's suppose you're a 10-year-old kid, and you have this magnificent experience, and you start telling everybody how you used to be a small girl in India, and you were hit by a truck in 1947, and the researchers go and find out that actually happened, 30 years earlier. And so how could that be? Well, one way, the Faber hypothesis, sure enough, that little kid was reincarnated from that girl 30 years earlier. Another one, however, if you could be psychic, the data in the laboratory shows that you can get data from the past, from the present, and from the future. So what Ian Stevenson coined was super psi hypothesis. In other words, being if you were a super psychic, you could explain things that you thought you were a 7-year-old girl way back when, and all you're doing is reporting something you're experiencing psychically and not survived your death.
We're going to come back with more with Ed May and Lloyd Auerbach in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed it is, with our special guests Ed May, Lloyd Auerbach, their work ESP Wars. Next hour we'll take phone calls with them about the psychic remote viewing world. And when I come back, let's talk more about what's going on in that area on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Lloyd Auerbach with us, Ed May as well. Both of you did a remarkable job with this. What, Lloyd, peers, colleagues, are they reacting to the ESP Wars book yet?
We've gotten some really nice comments from a few colleagues. We premiered the book at the Parapsychological Association convention, which the annual convention was held this year here in Northern California. So we got some very positive reactions from people, and we were starting to get some good reviews from them about it.
Ed, did you enjoy doing this?
It was a long project. We started it about 5 years ago, and
wow.
The first version of this, because when General Savin retired, I wrote him a letter and I said, "Hey, Alexei, why don't we co-write a book about the ESP fighting each other, spying on each other?" And he thought that was a great idea. So we had Alexei Yurovich Savin and a guy named Boris Ratnikov, a KGB guy, and another Russian and two American colleagues. We wrote this book, and to be perfectly blunt, it was terrible. It was written by a committee. You should never have a book written by a committee because it read like that. And I've written tons of technical ESP reports and physics reports, but that's not the way you want to write a book. And I knew Lloyd had written a bunch of books, so I said, "Lloyd, help! Can you rewrite this book so that people can enjoy reading it?" And he said, "Sure." And so, you know, that's what the book we're now talking about. He really took the material that we had gathered both in Russia and in here and put it together in a readable form. And it's fascinating. And I'm finding many of my colleagues outside the parapsychological community are buying this book, and they want me to sign it for them, and they ask me all kinds of questions. Yeah, good
reason. What about the very secretive Chinese, Ed? What are they doing?
Well, I've got good news and bad news, and it was the same news. I was honored to be invited to the Chinese Society for Somatic Sciences in Beijing 1 year. And there were 700 people in the audience. It was all about external qi, which is kind of psychic energy, if you will. And the purpose of the conference was to figure out, can we measure externally qi? In other words, we call it psychokinesis. And the good news is I was an invitee, and a colleague and I traveled to Beijing, and they were very nice to us and set us up. And because we were the guests of honor, we were sitting in the front row of a 700-seat auditorium, which was jam-packed. All of the presentations were in Mandarin, and none of them were translated. My host, who was the professor of English at Beijing University, had her best students sit between my colleague and I and whisper something in our ears every once in a while about what was going on. We couldn't leave. That said, we were able to meet up with some of the Chinese people. We learned later that the Chinese Society for Psychical, for Somatic Sciences, rather, was the civilian arm of the Red Army Psychic Program. So
really, that is not good news. Not
now, they make all kinds of claims, and we were unable to verify some of those claims. During the Stargate era, particularly before we had a purpose to do fundamental research, what we would learn, the intelligence community would say, "Oh, we've got this report from China. They claim they can do this particular psychic thing. Can you verify whether or not that's true?" And so they would give us a little bit of money, the U.S. intelligence people, and say, "Can you verify this report or not?" In almost all of the cases, we were unable to verify the claims coming out of China. Not in Russia, of course.
And I can add a little bit to that, too. Over the last few years, I've been consulted by a couple of Chinese scientists looking at psychic subjects in China, the most recent being a gentleman who has come over here a few times from China. And I've watched video recordings of a psychic who claims to be able to teleport things into a bowl of water under cover of a towel or a sweater or something else. You know, actually pretty suspicious stuff. As a former magician and current psychic entertainer, you know, there were a lot of things that were very suspicious about what was going on. And the most interesting thing, though, was when I was asked if I might go over to China. I said, "Sure, you know, if you want to bring me over and take a look at the guy in person, I'm happy to take to examine him, take a look." And I was told that if I do go, if I decide he's genuinely a psychic, I should not say that he is. Because if I said that he was genuinely psychic, he would no longer be able to make a living charging people money to watch his performances.
That's interesting.
The government would shut him down.
And that's how he—that's how he made the lion's share of his life.
Exactly. So, you know, that's an interesting ideological perspective, and it's very, very different than what we would be doing here. Now maybe, and I asked him, well, does that mean they're going to like whisk him off and start using his abilities for the army or something like that? He says, no, he just will not be able to perform because he can't call himself a psychic because of the materialist background and ideology that we have in our country. That's what he said.
Interesting.
Yet we knew that, for example, the from intelligence reports, that the Chinese had a very active group in their military. We don't know much about it then or even now, for that matter. But there's a cultural issue. That's what I'm so fascinated by, the difference in culture. Very, very long story short, during that meeting when I was there, I managed to talk to some of their scientists, and they say, oh, gee, we get nearly 80% hit rate in our ESP experiments in the laboratory. And I said, oh, my gosh, teach me, because we only get like 25 or 30% hit rate in certain types of studies. And they said, well, we only use Qigong masters. These are people who in India would be called super yogis. And I said, well, gee, that's great. How do you know that a particular person is a Qigong master? Well, they tell us. And I said, okay, that's fine. But since the purpose of this conference is to measure external qi, how does the master know that he or she is a Qigong master? And they, without hesitation, they said, well, they'd look at their ESP data. That turns out to be a huge circular argument, which they didn't understand at all. In other words, if you think you're a Qigong master just because you're getting good ESP and that is what you're using as evidence for your if you're using your ESP evidence to prove that you're a Qigong master, it's a circular argument. And that's a cultural problem that was not well understood there now.
In terms of the psychics, Ed, who were working in the SRI program, who do you think was the best?
Well, that's a hard question, an easy question to ask, a difficult one to answer, because some people were good at some tasks, other people were good at other tasks. For example, if you wanted to find something, a human being that was lost somewhere, and I can't even mention her name, her name's Angela Ford, you would go to Angela Ford because she is really good at finding lost people. If you wanted to find out what was going on with some underground nuclear facility, there would be two or three other people you would ask, and so on. They had specific abilities at various parts of being psychic. We rarely found people who were good at everything.
How was our dear friend Ed Dames?
Well, I never had an opportunity to work directly with him. He never participated in laboratory studies, so I can't verify whether he was good, bad, or indifferent.
Paul Smith?
Same. Most of these guys in the Army are well-meaning guys, and some of them have set up shop trying to teach people to do remote viewing.
Sure.
And I applaud their sort of enthusiasm. Unfortunately, most of them are not well-trained as scientists, but they're doing the best they can.
And in terms of pure science, where are we today, Ed Lloyd or Ed, in terms of science trying to decide what the heck this is?
Well, there's two answers to that, and Lloyd, I think, will be able to chime in too.
Yeah.
The first answer is there a phenomenon worth studying? And I think even skeptics are saying, yes, there's now a phenomenon worth studying. One of the most notable skeptics is Professor Ray Hyman from the University of Oregon. He's Professor Emeritus. And even he agrees that there is something funny going on here, and now we need to set about trying to figure out how that actually works. The second part of that is, how does it work? And the short answer is, I don't know. We have some clues, and they're physics clues, and I'm actually involved in a series of experiments right now that are proving to be very, very fascinating in terms of giving hints about how precognition might work.
What's your guess? And then we'll get to you.
What's my guess? I think all ESP is based on precognition. And actually, there's an idea in physics which is really interesting, and that idea is, if physics does not explicitly forbid something from happening, then it must happen. It's mandatory. And what we're seeing now in the physics community, particularly in cosmology, there are certain things that suggest that there is ways of getting information from some future, non-inferential future. And if that's true, then it must happen. So we're on the very edge of being able to understand how precognition might be possible, at least from the physics perspective. How that information gets into the head is still wide open.
Go ahead, Lloyd.
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of problems. You were asking about where science stands on this, and of course, there's not a lot of scientists who are willing to take a stand on this. They'd all, for the most part, at least publicly state that there's nothing to any of this. But as Ed said, we are beyond gathering evidence. We have so much evidence. If we could, it'd be nice if people would look at it before making a statement that there is no evidence. What's going on, the models, we're just not, there are suspicions, as Ed said, but we're not quite there yet. But there's a lot of things that are human in nature that we don't know how they operate. And the benchmark for all pharmaceutical research is the placebo effect, and yet there's no explanation for the placebo effect. In fact, very little research on what the placebo effect actually is. It just is used as the excuse for something, you know, when people feel better, for the most part. Even though there can be real physiological changes with placebo as well. So there's a lot going on in a lot of areas of science that are just taken for granted. And some of them, personally, I think placebo effect actually falls into the realm of, since it's mind-body, it does fall into what parapsychologists would do. There just are not enough scientists from all areas with new ideas and different ideas than what perhaps we have in parapsychology to bring to the table. We need them. We need a little bit of brainstorming, but we need people to actually step forward and admit their interest and actually start looking at these questions.
Yeah, George, there's some good news hiding under this. About 25 years ago, it was very suspect, if you were a mainstream scientist, to even look at something called consciousness. And so all of the neuroscience people and the psychology people and the cognitive science people, they could not, even though they might have been immensely interested in what is the nature of consciousness, how do we even define consciousness, and are animals conscious, and so on. And now, almost every university has departments devoted to looking at the nature of consciousness. So maybe 25 years from now, there'll be university departments set up to try to figure out how psi works.
What's your take on the evidence, Ed, of remote viewing? Do we have hard evidence? Really? Okay. What is it?
Well, you can't. That's an easy, one of those easy questions with a difficult answer. Anything that's statistically based, and right at the moment, even our best remote viewers don't perform well every time. They perform well above what might be expected by chance.
So why is that, though? Why do they
fail
sometimes?
That's a good question. Even expert skiers fail sometimes, and sometimes concert violinists screw up in the middle of a concert. We as humans have a lot of individual variations in the way we perform. We're tired, or who knows what all. Maybe we ate the wrong thing for breakfast.
Yeah.
There's a great deal of variability in the way we perform, and in ESP, it's huge. I would say, I have hard statistics. Typically, under laboratory studies, to get it right by chance would be 20%, and our people routinely perform at 50%, not 100%. And why they don't is a huge research question. Now, I happen to think that there might be some fundamental reasons why it won't be any better than it is. There's some physics reasons why that might be the case, but time will tell whether that speculation is correct or not.
What's your
take on it?
Well, the evidence is there, and actually people can see examples of the non-classified remote viewings. There have been several experiments that Joe McMonagle has taken part in that are available through YouTube. There was an experiment that was done at the ASPR a number of years ago for a British TV show by Keith Harari as the experimenter, with actually a production assistant who worked on the show, who did a phenomenal remote viewing. You know, there are so many examples through television through video that are there that show that something is really going on here. And as much as the skeptics might say, oh, this was all made up, you know, it's pretty clear it's not. It'd take an enormous conspiracy to actually to do something like that. But there's a huge amount of evidence there in the laboratory. And Ed has another new book out called Anomalous Cognition, which is a lot of papers about remote viewing, which has a lot of the laboratory and other evidence there from the sciences as well. But there's great evidence here that people can just take a look at. It's a mounting pile of evidence that's there.
Actually, George, you may be aware, there is a huge debate going on right now within mainstream science as what constitutes evidence.
Yeah.
You know, everybody likes to say, well, you don't have any evidence for it. But then you sit down and ask those people, well, what would be sufficient to cause you evidence for something? In fact, I wrote a paper and presented a paper at American Humanistic Psychology Conference once on evidence versus belief in physics. And it's a very complicated question because if you present something at a physics conference, it's not just what you say and what you present. It's who you are, what laboratory you work from, whether people like you or not. There are all kinds of social circumstances which determine whether or not people accept your evidence, even though the evidence might be true.
You know, it is. It's remarkable how it does work. And I know how, Ed, you think it's attached to the brain. I think there's something else out there in the universe mm-hmm. that somehow we're all tapped into. Consider it, as I've said, the wireless internet out there. And we just ride this wave and we get to there. Lloyd, possible?
Well, you know, there are those physicists that would say that the smallest particle, the smallest thing you can get down to is actually information. The universe is made out of information. What I can say is that people do pick up information from the past, they pick it up from the future, they pick it up from the present at different locations. That's effectively what a haunting is, for the most part, when we're not dealing with what appear to be interactive type of ghosts. We're dealing, for the most part, with using the house or being in a place where you are focusing on an event that actually happened to living people previously. It could have been a week before, it could have been 50 years before. But that's the most common kind of ghostly experience. So there's clearly information that somehow we're picking up on.
Sure. Well, you know, George, what you've said is deeply embedded into Indian and Buddhist philosophy, and that they call it the Akashic Record. It's kind of like a giant library in the sky, and do you have a library card for it?
It's the cloud.
Well, yeah, that's right. It was the cloud before the cloud.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. Where can we get the book, ESP Wars?
It is available through Amazon and all online booksellers at this point in time. And it's available on Amazon all over the world, in fact, through Amazon. It is also going to be in Kindle format later this week, as well as in Nook format. We're going to try and get into the other ebook formats, too.
All right. Well, good luck to both of you. We're going to come back with a final hour, and we're going to take phone calls here with Ed May and Lloyd Auerbach about ESP, psychic ability, remote viewing, you name it. And if something dramatic has happened in your life, why don't you share that with us too? I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.